Hello, everybody. Welcome to this debate on the expanded gallery at the Frieze Art Fair. Thank you very much for coming this morning. Now, our theme today is the expansion of the traditional art spaces of museums and galleries to embrace the once taboo media of design and film. It's a provocative issue and an extremely topical one. And to help us navigate it, we have the industrial designer Mark Neeson, the graphic designer Peter Saville, artist and filmmaker Francesco Vazzoli, and the curator Emily King. It's now 50 years since Richard Hamilton coined the phrase pop art, and he did so at a time when his work in interrogating the culture of industrial design, graphics and cinema through other media, mostly painting and photography, was considered radical. It's not considered radical today, but it's still very rich territory for artists, and design is a recurring theme in the art of Andrea Zittel, Jorge Pardo, and Tobias Rehberger, and others. But designers like Marty Giegsay, Jürgen Bay, and Peter are exploring the same themes in their own conceptual work through design. Just as artists like Francesco and Douglas Gordon are interrogating cinema, but in the media of film. There's a standard script as to how this came about, and it's a horrible generalization, but to cut it short, in ye olden days, art was deemed to be culturally superior to both design and film, and that was because artists were free to express themselves however they wished, in work that they mostly made themselves, whereas designers and filmmakers were seen as compromised, not only by the need to placate their clients, whether it was a manufacturer or a Hollywood movie studio, but by delegating production to other people. All that has changed when the process of conceptualizing and producing art became as important as the work itself, which was increasingly made by someone other than the artist. And obviously this was a very lengthy, complicated, and evolving process throughout the 20th century. Meanwhile, advances in technology have enabled designers to exercise greater creative control over the production of their work and allowed filmmakers to work more freely. All of this, combined with Hamilton's pop legacy, has imbued design and film with greater cultural currency, but to very different effect in terms of their relationships to both art and the art world. Film is now fully accepted as part of the cultural canon. Most modern art museums have added it to their collections and exhibition programs, although few of them have developed really engaging and ingenious ways of exhibiting it, or explored the obvious opportunities to do so online. Tellingly, a recent exception, the screening of Doug Aitken's Sleepwalkers at MoMA in New York in January, was screened literally outside the building on its facade. Most institutions still sink film into the black boxes of their cinemas or bury it into screens sunk into the walls. And possibly as a result of this, many artists are now seeking ways of exhibiting film outside these conventional art spaces, as Isaac Julian did last week here in London in his collaboration with Russell Malefant at Sadler's Wells. Moreover, film is still marginalized by the commercial art market. There are a few enlightened exceptions like the Kramliks and Fondazione Prada, but otherwise there are relatively few film collectors and it's a marginal presence at auction. The latter could of course be to film's advantage culturally, but the dearth of collectors has long-term implications for funding and hence for film's perceived importance within public institutions. Now, the situation of design is diametrically different. Its cultural relationship to art is still deeply ambiguous. The boundaries between the two have become increasingly blurred. It's more and more of a cliche to say so, but there's still no consensus on distinctions, definitions, and even about whether they matter. But unlike film, design is now a potent force in the commercial art market, but principally in the very narrowly defined field of limited editions of sculptural furniture that the auction houses have branded design art. Now, design art is a term that seems to have succeeded in offending absolutely everyone. Some people think it's pretentious, others that it's meaningless. A lot of designers think it belittles design, not least in implying that its only cultural currency is its proximity to art. And the debate has become much fierier as prices of design have rocketed. On Sunday, one of the chaise longues that Mark sold for a few thousand Australian dollars in the late 1980s and considered himself very lucky to do so will go on sale at Christie's for an estimate of up to $2.4 million US dollars. With prices rocketing like that, is there still a correlation between the cultural and commercial value of design art? Does it have any cultural value, or is it simply an expensive commodity, a beneficiary of the booming contemporary art market? And does it distort public perceptions of design by distracting attention from arguably more culturally sophisticated areas of design, often made by the same designer? Now, these are the sort of issues that we're going to be discussing this morning. Each of the panelists will give a very short take on their view of part of these questions, and we'll then discuss them before opening up the debate to questions from the audience. Now, first up is Peter Saville, who's slumbering beside me. Peter combines what conventionally have been seen as design and art in his practice, and he's done so throughout his career. He's designed much-loved artwork for bands like Joy Division and New Order, and now exhibits with galleries like Hotel in London and Galerie Neue in Berlin, and recently completed a solo show at the Migros Museum in Zurich. He's also playing a pivotal part in the regeneration of his home city of Manchester as its consultant creative director. And I'm going to ask Peter for his take on these blurring distinctions between what were seen as mass forms and their relationship to art and the art world.
Thank you, Alice.
Pleasure.
I don't know where to start on this, actually. It is enormously complex. It's both very simple and very complicated, I think, at the same time. I feel that these two very simple categories that we're talking about, design or art, I feel that they're actually such outmoded and out-of-date labels that it actually makes the argument impossible because the labels no longer apply. I mean, just as everybody was coming in, Alice asked me, how do I describe what I do? Am I designer, artist, consultant? And I actually don't have an answer to that. I don't actually know how to describe what I do in any of the kind of given or traditional formats. I think that the labels are very much defined by marketplaces now, and that if the work is brokered within the context of design, then you're being a designer, and if the work is brokered in the context of art, then you're being an artist. And this doesn't really do justice to people's work and how they practice it. I actually feel that all of the work should be put on some kind of sliding scale now, something like a sort of tube line, with the old idea of design or functionality at one end, and perhaps the old idea of art and aesthetic investigation at the other end. And I would put much of the work, nearly everything, somewhere on that sliding scale between the two. Design isn't really addressing many functional problems or functional issues anymore, and I really don't feel that art is concerning itself purely with the exploration of aesthetics. I think that all of the things we're talking about fall somewhere on a line between the two. As for what somebody chooses to buy and what they choose to pay for it, I think that that is a free choice for anybody, and if they wish to pay £2 million for one of Mark's chaises, then I think they're entirely at liberty to do that. People pay lots of money for sort of crocodile luggage. I don't think we can quantify things on how much it costs. I think we can only quantify things on their relative importance to social culture. And with regard to that, I think, and with regard to the understandings of the art market, big prices in the art market are usually associated with investment value. And I think as soon as you bring the investment criteria into the argument, then it becomes an objective decision rather than a subjective decision. So if somebody wishes to pay £2 million or £20 million for my work or Mark's, that's absolutely fine. Whether it's a safe investment is another thing. And I think with regard to investment, objective decision-making has to come into play rather than subjective. And to the notion of the gallery expanding, I sort of feel like it's being stuffed rather than expanding. So rather than the gallery, the context of the gallery or the realm of the gallery expanding as a result of, in a way, intellectual investigation, I feel that it's actually just being stretched by marketing opportunity.
Well, thank you. That was great, Peter. Somber, though, your conclusion is, and we can obviously come back to a lot of the issues you raised later. We're now going to go on to Francesco, who's exhibited his films in museums, galleries, and biennials all over the world. He's now preparing to commandeer the Guggenheim Museum in New York for a live performance starring Cate Blanchett, I think as Marlene Dietrich, later this month, and for a solo show at the Pinakothek in Munich. He has also straddled design during his career and what traditionally has been called craft too, because his first job was as a lighting designer for Floss, who Marx also worked for in Italy, and one of his early media was Petit Point Embroidery. So over to Francesco.
Thank you. Is it working? Yes. I've been thinking a lot about what to speak about exactly in this panel, and then I just thought just this morning I changed my plan and I realized I've been working for the last 10 months on a project that somehow involves design and art and film on different levels. Alice quoted Prada Foundation as one of the few institutions that supports video and film artists in a very generous way, and I approached them like almost a year ago with the idea of doing a remake of the Kinsey Report, which is this sexual chart of the sexual behavior of Americans done by Alfred Kinsey in the 50s. So we came up with creating an alliance between me and some professors at UCLA and with the help of the Hammer Museum. And so we are now working on this idea of, you know, making a real scientific questionnaire accompanied by a repertory of visual images about sexual behavior, and then to turn this entire operation into a website and into a real sexual questionnaire that should really function as a way to chart sexual behavior today, possibly worldwide. One component of this project that I had from the beginning was the idea of having an architect that I respected or that I was fascinated by to design this, as I called them from the beginning, love cabins, where people should go in and through a computer answer to this sexual questionnaire. So I approached a figure that I've always respected very much. His name is Ettore Sotsas. He's a very well-known, respected designer. And so we started collaborating on this project. And so this morning I thought that in a very poetic way, Ettore embodies this, at least for Italian culture, he has always embodied this figure of a designer and artist at the same time for his personal history, meaning he has shown his work in art galleries many times, and his furniture compared to the ones of his design compared to the ones of other designers that were his contemporary has always had a more, so to say, artistic rather than utilitaristic approach to culture. So I thought, you know, why am I doing this? Why am I involving a designer like Ettore? Why am I doing a film? Why am I doing a questionnaire? Is this a notion of expanding the gallery, expanding the visibility, expanding the market? What is that about? I agree completely with what Peter said, that I think those boundaries have radically changed. And I am not capable of, I'm not a historian, I'm not a critic. All I know is that each one has his own project, and if the project is strong, it will find a place, a category to which it belongs to. That's the only contribution I can speak for myself.
Thank you. We're now going to hear from Mark, who's one of the world's best-known industrial designers through the products and environments he's developed for multinationals like Ford, Nike, and Qantas, and the new space leisure spacecraft that he recently unveiled in Paris. He's also the reigning superstar of the so-called design art market, having staged a solo show at Gagosian in New York earlier this year, and is the only living designer whose work has sold for over $1 million at auction. Obviously, Christie's is going to push that up over $2 million if they have their way on Sunday. And Mark's going to talk about the role of limited edition furniture in his working practice as a designer.
Hi, everyone. I guess rather than explain my point of view on whether I think it's interesting or relevant, I could just explain how this kind of whole thing fits in within my own work and how it has kind of evolved within my career. I am a designer. I consider myself a designer and not an artist. I always have considered myself a designer. Even though I went to art school, I never studied design. But then someone once reminded me that you don't have to go to art school to be an artist, so I've never considered it a particular disadvantage. And one of the reasons I started doing this kind of what is, I think, badly termed as kind of art furniture, or what, I can't remember what you called it, Alice, but whatever it was,
It was Phillips de Fiori, it's design art.
Design art, yeah. I mean, I really feel like a kind of an innocent bystander in the middle of this whole thing. Nonetheless, I am kind of a lucky innocent bystander, I suppose. But the reason I did that stuff, and I've been doing it for about 20 years, it was the very, very first work that I did. And the reason I did it was because I had to do it. Where I grew up and where I trained and where I first started making my work in Australia, there wasn't... there was kind of very, very little opportunity for people like me to go and get their work manufactured. And in any case, at that point in your career, it's very, very difficult to go to a manufacturer and convince them to make anything anyway. So I was really obliged to kind of make this stuff by myself and try and sell it. That Lockheed Lounge, which is now selling for, perhaps in excess of $2 million, I made in my backyard and sold the first one for $3,000. And clearly the thing has a life of its own and has gone on to sort of achieve these nutty prices without me. But I made this work as a means to an end. It was all I could do in order to realize my work. No one would manufacture it for me, so I just simply had to do it myself. And that was how it all started. So it's interesting that it's become somewhat of a trend and a sort of a topical one at that right now. But it's important to point out that I've always done that. It's not something that I've just started doing recently. I've been doing this for 20 years. As an adjunct to what I refer to as my day job, which is primarily working now in the aviation industry. I'm designing suborbital aircraft, mostly things for the aviation and aerospace industry. So it is completely sort of diametrically opposed to all of the stuff that Alice was referring to. But I still find it important to be able to do that kind of work because it's the only forum in which I'm able to express myself completely without having to listen to anyone else telling me what to do. So I can just kind of do this stuff it's a sort of a technical exercise. It's a way for me to relax in a weird kind of way because without having a client breathing down my neck. And I've always exhibited my stuff in art galleries, interestingly, bizarrely. I designed a prototype aircraft and exhibited it 4 or 5 years ago at the Cartier Foundation, which is theoretically a space reserved for high art. Because I simply couldn't go to an aircraft manufacturing corporation and convince them to make this thing. I mean, they just sort of laugh at me and ridicule me. But of course, when you go outside of a certain area, into another area, like the art world, everyone sort of takes you seriously all of a sudden. And it's completely bizarre. So I have all of these people in the aviation industry thinking how incredible it is that I've managed to design this prototype aircraft. And all of these people in the art world thinking how incredible it is that I've designed this airplane and exhibited it in an art gallery. But for me, it's just a means to an end, simply. You know, I'd rather have my stuff in art galleries because art galleries look better and they make my work look better.
Well, over and out from Mark. We're now going to move on to Emily, who's a design historian and curator. She contributes regularly to Frieze and Fantastic Man magazine and has edited a book on Peter's work and written one on the work of Robert Brown John. And she's now co-curating the exhibition Wouldn't It Be Nice? Wishful Thinking in Art and Design, which opens later this month at Centre d'Art Contemporain in Geneva and will address many of these issues. And Emily is going to chart the historic relationship between design and art.
I'm only going to do that briefly, actually. I just want to talk a bit about the background. I mean, I've thought a lot about these issues, and I've talked to Alice a lot about them as well, so I hope this isn't going to feel like coming in on the middle of a private conversation. I mean, the reason that they sort of press on me is that I've always concerned myself with design. I've always been a design historian, but I've often written about design in an art context for art magazines. And increasingly, I've curated shows at the Design Museum, but increasingly I'm being asked to curate shows of design in an art context, which is, I mean, it's quite kind of interesting shift. I mean, but that said, it's hard not to feel second best because, I mean, there aren't many design historians around, and people do find it quite hard to understand what I do, and they find it hard to imagine that design could merit someone who would only think about design in that context. And I'm afraid Francesco just touched a nerve by suggesting I was a designer, which many people assume. And it's one of those fine things I find really irritating, that design, it's not enough just to think about design historically. You'd have to want to do it because surely it's kind of easy enough. Anyone could turn their hand to it. It's not like art. It's not distant. It's not mythical. It's something anyone who thinks about could have a go at. So, I mean, by sticking with the design camp, I'm kind of quite, you know, I'm actually trying to defend design, really. But let me start with sort of stating the obvious. I mean, there are no absolutes in this debate. There's nothing essential about the nature of contemporary art. There's nothing essential about the nature of contemporary design. And there's nothing essential about the nature of the contemporary gallery. And when sort of Peter and Francesca rightly point out that the terms art and design really don't fit these days, I'll say that maybe they never fitted. You know, there was a brief time. The terms art and design that we use now were kind of invented really at some point in the 20th century, maybe kind of after the Second World War. And they held for a while, and now they're slightly pushed apart. But actually, if you look before that, really art and design have been very different things over centuries, and you know, their positions always been kind of jostling in relation to each other. I mean, I really think the split that we perceive today kind of began with industrialization, when designers were really asked to kind of start working within the kind of schema of industrial production. And as a result, artists began to kind of mop up kind of messier impulses, you know, both for the pleasure of private collectors and for kind of mass enjoyment in museums. So really, suddenly, design became a kind of very rational business, and art became an irrational business. And I think designers and artists have both tried to resist this. I mean, both, it's a ridiculous split. You can't split your kind of way of creating in one side or another. And so, you know, if you look right back at, you know, the end of the beginning of industrialization, William Morris tried to kind of invent a craft practice that was kind of an all-encompassing design art practice and kind of would have rendered any separate practices of art and design completely irrelevant. And then later, someone like an early modernist, such as Leslie Moholy-Nagy, really tried to kind of make design an all-encompassing thing that sort of included art, you know, really spotting that you couldn't kind of be rational without the irrational as well. Like, you know, kind of rational impulses always had a kind of side about pleasure, pure enjoyment, irrationality. But I think after the Second World War, and really maybe with the kind of onset of corporate modernism, I think art really took off on its own kind of path, and art began to seem like a place where you could express yourself. And I mean, even the notion of pure unfettered expression is quite a kind of bizarre notion. I mean, when you ever free of anything, I mean, that's a kind of issue I don't want to pursue much longer because it's very difficult. But I do think after the war, you know, design was really placed in the service of capitalism, and art effectively became kind of capitalism's little pet, and in a sense that became the kind of split. But I don't think artists and designers, I mean, they resisted it in the early 20th century, and they continue to resist it now. And specifically looking at design, I mean, in the early 1960s, groups such as Artigram kind of really kind of tried to fight against the kind of modernist, you know, corporate modernist look and trying to suggest alternative solutions. And their work did, you know, didn't get much further than the conceptual stage. But other designers, you know, actually working within the scheme of industrial production, such as Achille Castiglioni, actually managed to produce brilliant objects that were critical and quite reflective of the situation in design at the same time as being mass-produced, mass-bought objects, you know, and they're just kind of fantastic things. So designers have often managed to kind of negotiate themselves little paths in spite of what's going on. And I think that continues today. I mean, a couple of names that Alice mentioned, Jürgen Bay, Marty Guichet, Martina Gamper, who's got a show now. They find ways of working within design that's kind of intelligent, critical, but actually is absolutely design. But to move on, I mean, I don't think that makes it art. You know, it's intelligent and it's critical, but really specifically, it deals with issues about design. It comes from design. And you can sort of suggest that the boundaries are eroding, but it makes no sense to wish them away, because then you lose all sense of historical specificity, and the kind of interesting thing about either art or design is kind of just completely lost, and you're just left with this kind of dirge of things that seems to have no background, no interest, doesn't seem to address anything. And I do think that the people keenest to erode the difference between art and design these days, and the kind of the whole dialogue about the kind of boundaries breaking down is really, I mean, it really comes from the people hoping to, the gallerists hoping to sell design and expand their commercial territory. I know that sounds very cynical, but really, when people have kind of attacked me and Frieze for its kind of conservatism regarding design, it generally is that they want to sell design within the fair. They want to reach these collectors. They want to reach these real high rollers. And you know, and you can set up these design art fairs, but they don't really get the high rollers in, so they just want to be in here. And I just think it's kind of, I mean, it's slightly uncomfortable, and you can see why. And you know, as Peter says, there's no reason design shouldn't be expensive. Design is brilliant, and I'm really excited by high auction prices for brilliant pieces of design that encapsulate great design ideas. And I think, you know, if actually design could invent a scheme where people like Mark, you know, can practice, experiment with techniques, experiment with materials, that's really glorious. And it's just a bit belittling, as Alice said, of design, to have to slap art next to it to kind of make that worthwhile. So, I mean, a few things in conclusion. I would say art and design continue to be very different disciplines, and they do exist and kind of on either side of an intellectual boundary, but that is to both of their benefit, that there are boundaries and there are intellectual threads. But of course this boundary might change and always certainly will change. It's changed in the past. Where it exists now is very, very specific, so you can't imagine that it will actually be fixed in any way. Maybe the gallery is stuffed, but I do think, I mean, I'm excited by the opportunities that I'm given to curate design in an art context. And I do think that art and design deserves the kind of reflective space that the gallery gives it. And I think, you know, I'm pleased that that's happening, and I hope it continues to happen. And just a final thing, I mean, it's not boundaries that are problems. I know this isn't really the title of the talk, this is my own kind of personal thing, but it's not kind of boundaries between disciplines that are problems. Really, it's hierarchies that are problems. And I think boundaries are kind of a part of exciting intellectual debates, and hierarchies are all about money and collecting.
Thank you, Emily. Now, Francesco, if we can bring you in and return to film. Emily has talked about the dichotomy between, or perceived dichotomy between the industrial and art, the experimental work that Mark and Peter have talked about. In your personal practice as a filmmaker and an artist, have you ever felt the tension of that dichotomy? I mean, the generation of artists before you, like Julian Schnabel, David Sally, Robert Longo, all sought to make Hollywood-financed feature films with greater and lesser degrees of success in the 90s. You draw on Hollywood's history, its pulp relics in Caligula, trash television in E! Entertainment. You draw on all that subject matter in your work, and yet it seems to have remained located within an art context. So have you felt the tension between the two, or have you felt able to circumvent that?
I felt the tension. I have to confess, maybe there was a moment where I wasn't so sure. I mean, it's the truth. It's like I was just doing my things because I wanted to do them, and I just had to do them and whatever. I really wanted those actors in my work, and I was ready to do anything in my possibility to get them to work for me. And so I ventured through the paths of Hollywood or other productional system.
Actually, very quickly, for anyone who hasn't been lucky enough to see Francesco's films, he is the greatest unsung casting director in Hollywood, because he's had Cate Blanchett, Helen Mirren, Benicio del Toro, Sharon Stone, Bernard-Henri Lévy. So he has persuaded an enormous number, some of the most iconic figures in contemporary cinema, to appear unpaid, I think, in his films.
Yes, always unpaid.
Back to you.
So I don't know. I think for a moment in my life, I so now I am quite sure I don't want to be a filmmaker, and I don't want to be involved in Hollywood, but not for any high moral stance, just because I have the impression that the art world can provide me with the freedom and the funding that in Hollywood would be so much harder to get, and I would have to deal with much more horrible people. And so it's basically, it's not that I am noble and I say like, oh, you know, I am above Hollywood or whatever. I just, I felt that tension, and as I said in my very basic statement at the beginning, you know, which, you know, you just have to do your thing, and wherever, you know, I think our duty as artist or designer, I really like when Mark said, like, I had to do that, you know, how did you say when you did that in your backyard? In your backyard, you know, you just had to do it. You didn't know. I mean, I imagine, you know, which is like when I do Caligula, or now that I want to turn the Guggenheim into a Broadway theater, I know I have to do it, and it's like running really fast, like in that movie from Nouvelle Vague into the Louvre or whatever. And it's like then, as I said, like it's people like, you know, like Emily, they have to, you know, like they make boundaries, they discuss those boundaries, they try to defeat the notion of hierarchies, that's their job. I really think that, you know, we just do whatever, and then we get criticized, we get attacked, you know, but we really, as we have to do it because we feel that's what we have to do. Like when I wanted to do this election campaign and I wanted Sharon Stone against Bernard-Henri Lévy, I felt I have to have these two people to play president, and I did anything it took. And then, is that an answer?
It's a total answer, of course.
I mean, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot with specifically art that deals with design, like Pardo or Rehberger, is that it's not design, it's art about design. It's art that takes design as its subject. And is your film or is it film about film? I mean, it is film, it's not film, it's film that addresses film and that asks you to reflect on film.
I think it's much worse. I think it's about myself.
Okay. Well, it's all about you.
Emily, that's an interesting point. This notion about, you know, art about art, art about design, film about film, art about film, whatever. What that sort of reveals is that people do things, and the things that they've done then become the new landscape in which we live. So the art about it, or the design about it, or the film about it, isn't really about it as much as the new landscape. I mean, sometimes I think that, you know, we have another way to understand landscape now. You know, landscape as in not just, you know, the geography of what's around us, but the technology, the media, the information, the social conditions around us. And if Francesco makes a piece of moving image that in a way quotes or looks into or references a film, is that film that he's quoting not actually just another part of life, you know, as life has kind of built up on top of itself. And I think that's, I mean, it's interesting to think of, like, what, you know, what is the world that we live in now? You know, and is the world about just existence in the way that it, you know, it might have been in previous eras and previous centuries? You know, our world now is more about actually the things that we've made and that we live amongst than the kind of natural conditions that actually we're trying to exist in.
But Peter, you throughout your career have critiqued the material culture around us.
Yes.
In both your early commercial projects, which you did as a young graphic designer, whether it was at Factory Records or working for a fashion designer like Yoji, you always had something to say and you always expressed it through your creative work. Now you also are able to express it through more experimental work that's shown in a gallery and given the degree of reflection that Emily referred to. Is there a tangible difference between the two?
No. Except you get to more people with a product. I think that, I mean, Emily mentioned the art context at the beginning, and that made me wonder it made me wonder about the art context and what the art context means now. And then later she mentioned a reflective thought. And I think that that's a really ideal way to understand the art context now. The art context to me is not necessarily something where you put art, because it's difficult to say what art is now. I mean, there's a tent of it behind us, and it's of very varying degrees, but it's all somehow labeled art because it's in a large tent called Art Fair. But, you know, some of it's great and a lot of it isn't. But the interesting thing is the notion of the kind of the reflective thought, a place where things can be given thought. And I think one of the things that designers, I mean, you know, designers, everybody wants to be an artist at the moment, because the artists are the new kind of, you know, rebel role models. You know, they were rock stars, and then for a while it was fashion designers, and now it's artists. Everybody wants to be an artist at the moment. And it's interesting, you know, what is it that they want out of being an artist? And I think one of the things they want is to be able to make something that people think about.
But don't you feel you did that with your commercial work? Because if you think of the emotional investment that people made in the classics, your Joy Division and New Order album covers, which Francesco was saying the other day, are huge gay icons, and doubtless will be for many decades come. Can any work that you show in a gallery, do you believe it will be as important to people and touch them as profoundly?
Probably not.
As
but
that?
The reason that I was able to do that on a record cover is that you cannot call a record cover a design problem, especially the old paper ones. There is no design problem. I mean, just before we started, we looked at Mark's telephone. He's got an iPhone. In the old days, a telephone receiver was something more complicated than that, because there were physical properties that early technology had, and designers were asked to, in some ways, aestheticize that and to make it more pleasing and to make it, you know, maybe easier to hold and more ergonomic. There is, with so many of the things that we make now, there is no problem at all. There is no design problem with a motor car now. There is no packaging problem in a record cover. There's no design problem with Mark's iPhone. In fact, most of the things that we have now could be kind of blank, you know, rectangles, but there's a limit to how many rectangles that we can have in our life. So, I mean, if you are so-called designing an iPhone, what are you doing? I mean, what is functionality now?
Well, can we bring Mark in on this? Because you explained very eloquently how the experimental work of the limited edition furniture you make and continue to make sits alongside the sort of rigors of your industrial practice. And you explain that in a sense that's sort of playing for you. It's something you love to do and it gives you a sense of freedom that your commercial commissions can't. And I completely understand that. But why then do you still lumber yourself with the design problem in that the end result is a chair or a table? It's recognizable still as a piece of furniture. Why haven't you been tempted to liberate yourself from that and express yourself more freely?
Yeah, why not?
Well, I often think about that, and my life would be a hell of a lot easier if I just stopped designing things and worked in the way that artists work. But the fact is, I'm sort of compelled to do what I do. You know, I can't stop. All of the different things that I do feed each other and in a sense sort of inspire each other. All of the technical problems that I'm making for myself and solving when I do these sort of one-off, you know, these limited edition things, and they're only limited edition because I can't be bothered to do that many of them, you know, all of that knowledge comes from having solve serious industrial problems. You know, I couldn't do the limited editions if I hadn't done the kind of the hard slog, figuring out, you know, why certain materials, you know, function and why certain technologies and certain materials work in certain ways. Then, you know, I'm able to sort of experiment with the unique pieces, and then that in turn sort of feeds back into my design practice because, you know, I've been able to sort of solve those problems in my own time and in my own space without any sort of commercial or practical restrictions. And then that sort of helps me to do the serious design stuff. Although I guess I'm not really answering your question, you know, why do I keep designing? I mean, I actually don't design that many chairs anymore. I do design chairs for aeroplanes. You know, I don't know anyone that likes flying. And I thought, well, you know, rather than designing sort of chairs for a terrestrial environment, you know, I'd be much better off trying to kind of, you know, make aeroplanes more comfortable for people. I don't actually think, you know, I can't be bothered designing furniture for you know, sort of posh Italian companies anymore, to be really honest with you. I find that a kind of waste of time. You know, the Capellinis and the B&Bs and the Poltronas and, you know. But I do think it's important to be able to kind of address real issues and real problems and you know, real ergonomic and practical issues that people have. And I think, and I think as a designer, that's very, very important.
I mean, so, Alice, I mean, if Mark tackles a plane, that is, or anything like that, that is a real problem. And the word ergonomic or, you know, functional or the mechanical aspects of it, that actually is a kind of classic design problem. There is a problem that needs to be solved. And if you do a chair for Capellini, it's not a problem. It's a psychological problem. I mean, the problem, I mean, this is, Mr. Sotsas said this, the problem of the chair was solved quite a long time ago.
Not on an airplane, though.
No, not on an airplane. Or something like the what's the amazing kind of mesh chair called? You know, the one that you sit at when you're working on a computer.
The Eames.
No, not the Eames one.
Oh, the Aeron chair.
The Aeron. So the Aeron is a good example of somebody looking at some new issues and materials and new understanding perhaps of physical form or anatomy and trying to improve the chair. I mean, and it's kind of beautiful in a way. Or it has an aesthetic in a way. It has an aesthetic of some kind of technological advancement. So that, in a way, is part of the evolution of the chair as the problem of sitting. But that's like less than 1% of the chairs that get made. Most of the chairs that get made or commissioned are not actually problem-solving design commissions. They're psychological challenges to a marketplace. I mean, communications design is entirely about addressing people's sense of place or status. I mean, it's actually, most design these days is a psychological problem. You're requested to address the audience's psyche in some way. Not, I mean, if you're doing a telephone directory, but we don't even have those anymore, that's a functional problem. But that's like 0.001% of communications design, similarly with product design or jewelry or motor cars. It's a kind of psychological challenge of the marketplace.
But it's also the transition from a material to an immaterial design culture, because the great functional design problems of our time aren't three-dimensional objects. They're the software that drives them,
exactly.
That's invisible, intangible, and people don't see. I'm just going to bring Emily in here before opening it up
Fine.
To questions in the audience. And Francesco described a sort of state of grace for film in that he said that now as an artist working with film, he has both the creative freedom and also the financial flexibility to do whatever, roughly whatever he wants. He doesn't have to go cap in hand to Hollywood. Is design at that stage yet, or is it still evolving towards it?
But I would say, I mean, Francesco is an artist who works with film in a, I mean, and I don't want to draw analogies he doesn't like, but in the same way that Andrea Zittel probably is a design, is an artist who works with design. And I mean, I think Francesco can recruit the actors he gets, because they realize that he offers a kind of valve, an antidote to the films they're in. They kind of recognize in his work some kind of other side. So since Francesco is, and you know, artists who work with design really are on it in a completely different side to designers who want to find freedom through selling their work to galleries. It's a completely kind of different issue. But so looking at the other side, so in terms of finding kind of freedom, I mean, I wonder if art filmmakers are finding, I don't think they do find freedom. You know, people who want to work within a film context but want to work as kind of independent authorial director, I don't think that freedom is really available to them. And I think by trying to work within the gallery system, people like Mark, say Amanda Levitt, by working with galleries, are finding freedom to experiment with materials and techniques and processes that they haven't done so before. What I would say, though, is I'm not really sure. I mean, I think it's a really interesting small strand of design. For me, it's not design's big story, as I suppose we hinted at before. In a sense, I love seeing what they do. I think it's really exciting. And formally, it can be brilliant, and the kind of extremes of material can be brilliant. But I'm such a kind of purist, I just still can't help but think that design's main story is probably mass production. It's everyday lives. It's the texture of the lives around us. And I know that what you do will eventually feed in or does relate, because it is, you know, it is around us and everyone looks at it and it becomes the texture of every part of everyday life. So yes, they will find freedoms, and yes, it's interesting, but it's just a kind of side story in the larger history of design.
Okay, well on, sorry, Mark.
No, I just wanted to suggest, as I'm sure everyone knows anyway, that this whole debate has only come about because of commercial reasons. I mean, the only reason we're talking about this is because of the price that design is being sold. You know, if these pieces weren't being sold for such incredible amounts of money, we wouldn't be having this discussion, would we?
The discussion's come up a bit because of the convergence between all the disciplines. But, I mean, Alice, I've said this to you, but I think before I've said it to Emily, that to me the convergence is one of awareness. That everybody is sharing in the same information and everybody is working with the same visual codes and nobody really has a problem. I mean, the designers are artists. The artists are designers. I mean, you have to design a work. And I mean, most of the work requires, you know, a high degree of design to some extent, just solving how you're going to visually realize what you're trying to express. That is a design problem. It's really a matter of just where the work is brokered. And I mean, Mark, you know, said there were nutty prices being paid for, you know, some of his early pieces. I kind of challenged that. They're not nutty prices at all. They happen to be high prices, but they're not nutty. Some of Mark's early work is incredibly important in shaping the kind of socio-cultural evolution of the world. And so therefore it's important.
They're nutty prices in the design world, but they're anything but nutty in the art world.
Exactly, but they're important pieces.
The price issue is quite interesting. I mean, what I've, and again, I'm going to sound so kind of purist, but I noticed that design history is being rewritten by kind of galleries and collectors who've just picked on a kind of thread of designers who they're kind of selling off the archive at high prices. And kind of, you know, and so in a sense that, you know, now we're getting this kind of Genere, Prouvé, Perrion. They're all incredibly important designers, but in a sense, if you talk to a collector, they'll kind of give you this kind of 10-name 20th century design history, and they'll forget all the complexity and everything it existed in. And it's not just reinventing the present, it's also serving to reinvent the past as like a kind of...
Or Emily, reassess the past. Yeah. The past. I mean, to a certain extent, some of its times it's unfair, but where it's fair, it is only a matter of introducing a kind of some sort of parity. I mean, an awful lot of what the world's designers or engineers have done is just as important, possibly much more important in the last 100 years than a lot of artists have done.
Looking at engineers because they can't take their pieces home and put them in.
Exactly.
It's everything collectible that's available to collect becomes expensive.
It is true that it has caused revisionism, but hopefully that will be short term because this is a relatively young, immature market and should become more sophisticated as time goes on. At this point, I want to open it up to questions from the audience because I know a lot of you have got them. So could we have the house lights up, please? And starting with a question there, somebody's coming with a roving mic for you.
Thanks very much. Very interesting debate. I wonder whether, it's really a question for you, Emily, where you feel that contemporary craft is in this debate. Down in the Strand at Somerset House, there's another show going on called Origin, which is put on by the Crafts Council, and they have one also for international collectors at the B&A in the spring. Huge numbers all around the country, increasing interest of people who are investing and wanting to buy, whether it's ceramics, whether it's jewellery, whether it's furniture. And the word craft is not one, you've mentioned it with William Morris historically, very important in schools, but actually the label is getting subsumed in the hierarchy. You talked about it, and I'd be very interested to know what the place is, how we're going to keep it up there in the hierarchy because of the craft that goes with all the things you're talking about. And the history and all the things that have touched on. So your views, please.
Yes. This is very, just a very personal position, and you might not like it, but I always have hoped that craft would just be kind of subsumed in design because I think it's really interesting when people make things by hand, but it's really often really interesting when people make things by hand as part of a broader process. And I think, you know, as a kind of continuum of processes, I don't know if the craft is really separate enough or if it's really interesting taken as a separate entity. And I think it's a lot of the stuff that kind of floats under the craft banner, I find incredibly interesting, appealing, compelling. I'm not necessarily sure it does it any favours to kind of separate it off and try and create a kind of separate craft market. I think it's obviously people calling themselves craftsmen make compelling objects that people are really keen to buy. But I don't know necessarily if they need to hive themselves off and make objects for a crafts market, showing a crafts context for crafts collectors. I think it would be more interesting if it became part of a continuum. On the other hand, if for this kind of work to survive, you know, if for potters to be Arion being able to make pots and for things to be made on small runs by hand and find a market, then the term craft is necessary and the separate promotion of craft is necessary. Then as a kind of pragmatic choice, I would say keep craft in there. I'm not really sure right now there's a purpose for it.
It's only by hand.
What would you call craft then?
New technology is very much part of what's going on at the moment as well.
Mm. But in a sense, what then qualifies it as craft?
A lot of the things you've been talking about how people paint and the design, but I'm interested as to whether you think that there's a legitimate place for people who call themselves makers and are crafting things and feel very proud about it.
It's just the term, because crafting is making, but then making is also designing. Mark makes things, don't you?
Yeah.
Today we tend to call them more than crafts, designers, makers. So it's a way to self-production.
Yeah. But I think
it's very opportune to, because designers' production issues, today we tend to find ourselves a way to production. Mm. And the crafts has in this crafts council today, it's a bit like that. It's more designer-maker.
Okay, could we move on to another question? Sorry, one. If we have one in the middle there. And then we'll come back there and there.
This is a question for Alice and for Emily. We're talking about design, art design, this whole design boom stimulated in large part, let's say, by the market, right? Auction records and pricing and all of that. But for the reality of the design boom to actually fulfill the prophecy of the market, we need a generation of young designers, not only the superstars, but also a whole generation of young designers, just like we have a whole generation of young artists that were actually the ones that fueled the Frieze Art Fair. Is there this generation of young designers that are now emerging, and who is going to help produce these designers, just the way that Mark had trouble producing his first pieces? How is this going to happen? I mean, the design market can't just be about stars. It must also be about emerging design. Where are we going to find that? And is this prophecy going to be fulfilled?
Well, I think pragmatism will ensure that it is, because there is an emerging generation of young designers who will find life much, much, much easier than Mark's generation did. And just as his path was helped by his forerunners, people like Philippe Starck, who sort of made the media more aware of design, made manufacturers much more willing to be inventive in their commissioning of designers, Mark's generation has sort of upped the ante again. And if you look at a lot of the young designers who are coming out of design school now, particularly the master's courses of places like the Royal College of Art or Eindhoven or increasingly Delft and Ecal in Switzerland, they recognize that they can make a career out of limited edition pieces. And unlike Mark's generation of designers, they don't have parallel industrial aspirations. Obviously, some do. And this is an interesting, but possibly also a worrying phenomenon. I think the worst scenario is that we'll end up with a subset of designers who just do so-called design art and don't have the symbiotic relationship between their one-off work and their industrial work that Mark's generation has had. But there are now more design galleries opening. I mean, there are 5 opening in London as we speak. The auction market is ever expanding. There are more and more design fairs opening. So all of this will enable the next generation of young designers to make their mark much, much more quickly.
I mean, Emily? Do you think that exactly the same thing is going on in design as it is in art, in that if you go to Milan, there are kind of 22, 23, 24-year-olds producing work for big companies, aren't they? And the older generation are going, oh my God, they get snapped up straight out of design college now, in exactly the same way that people feel about art. Though I do think it is hard for them to find an industrial context in which to work. And I think a lot of young designers would prefer to be able to work within an industrial context, and are finding that they have to kind of produce work. You know, there are people like Torsten van Elten, they have to find ways of producing work and selling it, you know, in small shops. And in a sense, they can't rely on that old system of being picked up by a manufacturer, coming through a sort of apprenticeship, becoming a star. They really have to kind of find ways through this kind of new economy.
I actually disagree with that. I think mainstream manufacturers are far readier to gamble on young designers now. And also technology helps them enormously. I mean, Mark's career seems meteoric if you read the press release, but actually it's been a long, slow slog. It's much, much easier for a young design graduate now to make their mark more quickly. Technology enables them to work, produce pieces in limited runs of very high quality, much more cheaply and accessibly than they could in Yielden days when Mark was setting off. So I think life is easier for them.
Their complaints too easily.
Probably. Yeah. Okay, yeah. We had a question back there, and then I'll come to you.
Thank you. I've just read a really interesting book by Larry Shiner called The Invention of Art, where, this is a question to Emily actually, about critical discourses around design. And my understanding is that I agree there's actually a gulf between design discourse and art critical discourses, because they've come from the whole invention of the public sphere. In sort of post-Enlightenment coffee house conversations, early literary criticism. You know, art was very much part of that, but my understanding is that design wasn't, because it was dealing with a different category of being in the world, which is to do with kind of function. If we're now at a really interesting time when design is perhaps looking for a kind of critical value, which it can possibly be co-opting through the display in a gallery space, what does that say about the value of design criticism And why is there only one nascent MA in design criticism in the UK? It's so different.
Aren't there more than one? There's Middlesex.
I've started doing a little bit of research into it.
There aren't many. I mean, MA in I did the MA in design history at the Royal College, and there's the nascent one, isn't there, at LCP?
Yes.
Though criticism as an academic MA, even in art, is relatively recent. You had been an art historian.
I'm not so sure, though, because critical discourses around art are fecund.
I mean, design history is born from architectural history. And I, when I studied it, it was a kind of quite new discipline. It's getting more and more established. But I do think that people need to tell the stories about design, and it needs, you know, people need to make a case for design as a kind of cultural force. And I'd love to write about design more in mainstream papers. I'm very jealous of Alice to have the regular opportunity to write about design in the Herald Tribune. But it's very difficult because, I mean, all the major papers here run architectural columns, but very few of them ever treat design as anything other than a kind of consumer option. It's just put in the lifestyle pages, and it's simply what you can buy. They're not really prepared to commission critical pieces on design.
Can I say, I think there's something in the spirit of individuals that is slightly different. I think that some people are, in a way, they suit the notion of being an artist, and I think some other people suit the notion of being a designer. The notion of doing, from a design kind of sensibility, the notion of doing something in ones or twos, the notion of doing something to exist in the gallery, just in a somewhat removed gallery context, is kind of entirely counterintuitive to the notion of design. And I don't really think we're talking about design. I mean, if it's worth doing, why make it a lamp? There's lots of lamps out there. There's lots of ways of illuminating a room. If it's worth doing, why make it a coffee table? It's either an interesting three-dimensional aesthetic work or it isn't. But I think that this is we're talking about a modern version of objet d'art, or in a way, art light. I mean, the idea of designers purposely doing, you know, something as, you know, exclusively as a one or a two in order to present in the limited experience of a gallery is not actually, that is not design. That's like light art or art light, whatever you want to call it. And it's actually not a sort of, designers tend to look at the world around them and somehow want to make it better. There is a feeling to try to improve the world. That is the basic driving force behind a designer, to make the everyday experience better. And this is not a kind of an exclusive issue. Or you have something important to express in the context of aesthetics. And stuff in between the two is in a very fuzzy zone. And as Emily says, it is denigrating to design, and it actually isn't art. Actually, we're talking about kind of varying degrees of accessible art for a marketplace. And, you know, it's like dumb art for dumb people.
Okay, Mark, do you want to comment on that?
I was just thinking while listening to Peter that it'd be interesting to point out to everyone, from a designer's perspective as well, you know, again, to kind of go back to the economic issues, that this whole sort of phenomenon has also opened up and made life easier for designers in a lot of ways. Designers, young designers specifically, have been being essentially ripped off by their clients for a long time.
That's true.
And I look at this in part as a way of sort of getting our own back. Making a living for a change.
Okay, now we'll take one final question there.
Thank you. Could you briefly touch on the fairly new phenomenon that major art fairs are usually complemented now by design festivals, fairs? Think about Miami, where in recent years really evenings were filled with events in the design district, etc. And this is a phenomenon that's coming on stronger and stronger. So I would be interested if you could. For me, this is rather an expression of a new development that I would call design plus art equals lifestyle.
Yeah, culturalized shopping. And it's just different levels. It's just to me, it's just a question of what level you're at. And it's just various levels of culturalized shopping. That's why I said at the beginning that you have to put all of these things on some line and things fit in different places line. You know, that an iPod at one end, Damien's skull at somewhere a little bit further along the line. They're kind of culturalized shopping. I mean, if you have money to spend on kind of cultural status items or icons or symbols for yourself, and if you don't quite get what's in this tent, then you can go down to Hanover Square and you might kind of relate a little bit more to what's in a tent there. It's shopping.
Okay, so on that note, the sliding scale of culturalized shopping, unfortunately, I'm going to have to draw this to a close, long though we could continue to debate all these complex issues. So I'd like to say thank you very much to Mark Newson, Peter Saville, Francesco Vazzoli, and Emily King. Thank you.